There are two main elements that guide Rebecca Kleinberger's work as a voice technologist: how the voice has shaped the world, and how the voice shapes individual identity. And there are two scenes that help her explain all of this. The first one happens in a cave.
The first one brings us back 30,000 years ago, at the time where our ancestors left some of the early unknown form of art in painted caves, and in the form of painted animals and stenciled hands.
Recently, a team of researchers examined the sound properties of these caves. And Kleinberger says they noticed that in the parts where there was art, the drawings and the paintings, there was also a lot of resonance and echo. The scientists called them acoustic hotspots.
Because they're generally located in very deep part of the cave and hard to access, I would suggest that those acoustic properties are the principal reasons for the placement of those drawings. So our ancestors were exploring those caves, guided by the reflection of sound, certainly by using their voices, until they found a spot that enhanced their sonic beauty. And they decided to honor those spots through the drawings they left behind. So really, those early cave dwellers were guided by the experience of their voice to shape the world around them. Shaping the world based on the voice. And the second story is the one of Demosthenes, who lived around 300 BC and is considered the greatest orator of ancient Greece. And he really pushed oratory to an art. When asked to name the three most important aspects of oratory, he replied, "Delivery, delivery, and delivery." And what's really fascinating is that he's told to have had a speech impediment, some sort of stutter. And he trained himself by placing stones and pebbles in his mouth when talking.
I deprecate it not.
And this trick allowed him to gain a lot more control over his voice and mask his stutter, develop the R form, and become the man he is known for today.
Grant that we may speedily be released from our present fears and enjoy a lasting deliverance.
That's the second fundamental potential of voice technology. That's our ability to use the voice to change yourself, to change who we are in the world. Those are two types of voice technologies that humans have really done for a very long time. And those are the two fundamental motivations that drive my practice as a voice researcher and creative technologist.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rebecca Kleinberger says she likes to think of the voice as a way for us to touch each other. She'll explain what she means here in a moment, because this was the part of her research that interested us. Her work at MIT and elsewhere has been remarkably expansive, how the voice fits in neurology and physics, biology, not to mention computer technologies. But Kleinberger says when we make sounds with our vocal cords, we're not just hearing words and data. We're sharing who we are. The fact is, we don't really use our voices for ourselves, even though there is such a thing as an inner voice, which we will get to today. But our voices are mostly for others. Kleinberger describes it as a gift we give. Sure, it's about expression and communication, but it goes beyond that. She says voices are also about creating bonds. So we wanted to explore that idea today. Kleinberger joined us earlier in the week, live on stage at the Rose Wagoner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. The show was a celebration of the 20th anniversary of Radio West.
What do you think it meant or did for those prehistoric humans to hear their own voices reflected back at them in those caves?
What does it feel for most of us to hear our voice reflected? We're very familiar with our voice, but it's still full of mystery and paradoxes. And for ancestors, so early on, having such a deep connection, not only with the voice, but how the voice react with architecture, with the world around them, around us, whether we're using technology, and microphone, whether it's remote, whether it's distance in time, or whether it's really immediate in our relationship to the world.
What is it exactly that interests you about the voice? And I mean, like, exactly.
Most people can relate to having a voice. It's an object that the closer we get to it, the more it disappears, the more mysterious it becomes. Mm. There are so many paradoxes. It's really what makes us unique as humans, but it has deep similarities with how other animals communicate. The voice allows us to create common languages, but it's also a unique signature on how we project ourselves in the world, how we express ourselves, even just the etymology of expressing. It's really pressing towards the outside. Mm. So it's almost a definition of the voice. And I like this idea in science, in technology, or in everyday life to get used to look at the familiar with new eyes.
So our voice is so something that we just are so used to, but you're interested in, and some of your work is reminding us of how remarkable these basic things are. Is that one of the things that interests you about the voice?
Yeah, and I guess to continue answering your question about what attracts me toward that, we share our voice, we use our voice with technologies, but we rarely pause to think about what is present in our voice. And what really drove me to this field originally was realizing how little I understood about the voice. That even for me, that I'd been using it for 20 years, I had no idea how it worked, what I revealed through the voice, how it touched others. And it's also a great entry door to look at so many different fields, honestly. I didn't right away realize that the voice was it. I was interested in how we communicate, in what's going on in the brain, in who we are, and this question of know yourself. I think it's one for which the voice is a nice little window to start tackling some of those questions.
There are these two stories that you've mentioned, kind of moments of revelation, like when you knew the voice would be your life's work, at least as I understand it. And one of them, maybe a story you could tell about, you were working on the physical model of the voice. Mm-hmm. And you weren't studying voice at the time. You were studying, what, mechanical engineering or something?
Yeah, so my background is also a little bit eclectic. I started by studying math, physics. Then I wanted to touch the material, so I went into mechanical engineering. Then I realized that, oh, really, computers are an important thing in our life, and kind of understanding what's beyond it is also important. So I went to computer science, and then I arrived at MIT almost 10 years ago and was interested also in many different questions. I came across a lot of the work from Claude Shannon and the telephone and how we can communicate in distance and all those great theories about signal processing. And then I was curious about understanding the quantity of information, the degree of freedoms in the voice. And I said, okay, I'll just look at how it works. And that was just really a personal experience to go through this, those scientific inquiries of, okay, well, I've done mechanical engineering. I can just like model the voice with some masses and springs and do some models and realize that, well, it's more complicated than that. And there's a lot of things going on when we produce vocal sounds. So that was kind of the start of it, the spark.
The realization you've talked about, I wanted you to say something about this, that the voice is not just sound, that it's embodied. Talk about that as a concept, because it seemed like this was another important thing for you as you were thinking about wanting to study the voice.
Yeah, and it's still a point that keeps coming up in so many of my projects and whatever field I look into, whether it's neurology or biology, or a voice is always somehow embodied. And we're getting more and more used nowadays to interact with machine, to talk to our car, to talk to our coffee machine, and to hear voices that are, in a sense, disembodied voices that come from microphones, from speakers. But our brains are still so used to a voice being associated to a body that it's not something that we can just switch off and say, okay, I'm talking to Alexa now. So when we listen to another human being, we always infer a lot of things very, very quickly from hearing their voice. We infer their relative age and size and facial structure, where they grew up, and hormonal identity. And all of that is very subconscious. But when we listen to a disembodied voice, our brain still does the same work and still try to create a model of who is this entity that we're interacting with in terms of an embodied entity.
Like we create an image. Like when I'm talking to my Echo, exactly. I hear her, I'm like, oh, my brain is like, she's got brown eyes or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Are you trying to solve something or fix something? Because you've said that part of what you want to do is to help people, this is how you put it, understand themselves better through their voices, help people be better listeners, which I'm hoping you can teach us tonight, and have better relationships through. Are you trying to fix something? Are you trying to solve something? Or is that the way to put it?
Good question. Thank you for asking. Going back to this know yourself.
Yeah.
Imperative. A lot of our behavior are driven by who we want to be, what we want to project, the mask we want to give ourselves. And the voice is one of the primary ways that we project ourselves in the world.
Right.
And I think that there is also something in the voice, in our very complex relationships that we have with our own voice, that could help with some of this understanding, some of this realization of our own personal journey, because the voice keeps traces of all of our journey. And by having this reflection, this mirror of ourself, it could be a way to start accepting who we are and to start having a more healthy, peaceful, benevolent relationship with ourselves.
You're looking to help people make connections. Is that fair?
Yeah, connection with others, but also very profoundly connection with themselves. And I think the voice could be a great tool, a great membrane between what's inside, some deep personal world, and the outer world, and how we interact with others and society.
There's a researcher at Stanford named Anne Fernald, and she studies children's language development. And in the course of her studies, she went all over the world recording the ways mothers soothe their infants. And she identified four basic melodies that she heard over and over and over again. And it didn't matter the culture, it didn't matter the language, at least one of these melodies was always there. Fernald was on the public radio program Radiolab, and she said this. She said, "Sound is touch at a distance." Let's talk about that.
The voice is always somehow embodied. And one of the first real experiences that we have from the outside world is through touch. The skin is one of the largest organs in our body, so it's also one of the first to develop. And from this skin, we can perceive tactile senses and the perception of vibration. Our first sense is a sense of touch. And what do we touch? What are those potential sensorial vibrations that we perceive from inside the womb? The mother's heartbeat. and the mother's voice. We can think that a lot of the high frequencies would be filtered out, and most of the low frequency would be what remains. I'm not sure we can say they could recognize a voice right away, but they might recognize some elements of prosody, of musicality from a voice. So there might be very certainly some familiarity with the mother's voice from before birth.
Good night, room. Good night, room. Good night, pale. Something over the moon. Good night, light. In the red balloon. Good night, bear. Good night, bear. Good night, chicken.
I want to get to that question of touch, but how did our voices evolve? Why did we evolve voices? Do we know? Like, what is there an answer to that? Do we know?
Well, there are many hypotheses. They are kind of the even just the mechanical phenomenon in terms of evolution that started distinguishing the human voice, which is pretty different from some of us, our closer species, cousins. So there have been this whole like change in evolution of the angle between our head and our body. We don't really know if that drove bipedy or bipedy drove this, if it started with us starting to make more sound, which brought this kind of change, or if suddenly we were able to make more varied sounds. But that's also related with our brain becoming bigger in the back. So it's kind of this whole mix of conditions. The why is a tricky question in science. Yeah. but when we think about our current use of the voice and to what extent it's directly what the voice is for, or if we've been going through some variation in the use of it from some of our ancestors. That's an interesting one. I like to say that generally in our everyday interaction, we exchange data, we have meetings, we say things, but none of the things we say have any immediate relevance for our survival most days. So from this perspective, we may think that what the voice is for, or why it continued, why it became an evolutionary advantage, might have to be found somewhere else. And I really like the metaphor of social grooming. A lot of species, apes, mammals, and even birds, when it comes to creating mother-infant relationship, when it comes to resolving conflicts, to understand one's hierarchy in the group, or just to feel together, they're just going to go and groom themselves. And this touch element is very present. And I like to think of the human voice as a way of doing this social grooming.
So what does that look like? I'm trying to... So soothing, words of comfort. I'm trying to imagine like our prehistoric ancestors, before there was actual language, was there grunts of acknowledgement, of warning? Like, was that how we think that they were socially grooming?
Well, it's hard to imagine that words came first.
Yeah. You're okay. Yeah.
So there were interactions that were certainly more in the form of grunts, that maybe in the form of some very early chanting. Some people think that throat singings, so this completely different use of a voice box, predates or common use of the voice in society through speaking. Certainly some musical elements were already there. So you can think about singing, you can think about melodies, you can think about using loudness more than anything else to send messages. So there are interesting theories around why birds sing, right? It's a very common question in science. What are they saying? Can we decode their language? And one that I really like, that more and more scientists agree with, is, well, the song of bird, what a lot of them mean. I mean, of course, there is there's alarm call and there is morning calls, but a lot of the calls might just be interpreted as, hi, I'm there. Are you there? Hi, I'm here. Hi, that's me. Are you there? Who's there? I'm there. So you could also... Making your presence known, expressing yourself, being part of a group, and having this ability to know who is there without even seeing them. So I think the ability we have to recognize individuals at a distance in a forest might also be a big part of it.
How much of how we communicate comes from words? Like the words, it seems like maybe if we're humming to each other or if we're calling to each other in another way, the words aren't that critical in some ways?
Well, most of us have the experience of hearing other people speaking a different language.
Yeah.
And we can get a sense of what is understandable or not, but we can also think about those different layers of understanding. Even if I don't understand someone's language, from their voice, I still get a sense of, again, their, maybe not their gender, but at least their hormonal identity, their age, their shape, their mood. So a lot of those elements, which again, might be maybe more important than what they're actually saying as a concrete message. So even though our brain focus on maybe the words, our conscious brain focus on the words, there is another very important part of our brain that is going to capture a lot of those other elements and interpret them as, is it a friend? Is it a foe? How should I react? So how should I consider our relationship through the voice?
Rebecca Kleinberger, she's an expert on the human voice and a postdoctoral researcher at the Media Lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She joined us earlier this week on stage at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the voice researcher Rebecca Kleinberger. She joined us earlier this week live at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. We talked about how our voices work, how they connect us with each other and give us an identity. We also talk about how we have an inner voice and how we use our voices as a mask we present to others.
I want to ask about, come back to the social grooming idea. So this, Anne Fernald, her work at Stanford, mothers soothing their babies, that's social grooming?
Well, another thing that's very interesting with lullabies is that not only a lot of the melodies are quite similar, but some great research has also shown that the words themselves are very often, in many different cultures, the stories depict very terrible stories. They're often the stories of either children dying or bird dying or someone being dismembered or being eaten alive. It's very classic in so many cultures. So that's another interesting disconnect between the soothing of the prosody and the words themselves. And what some hypothesis about why is that is that the lullabies are not only there to soothe the baby, but also in a way to soothe the parents singing. And a way to soothe parents is through some cathartic experiences. All those fears that we might have of the baby dying, we can express them in a way that, again, socially acceptable, as long as the melody is really sweet. The melody is for the child. The lyrics are for the parent to express some of the fears that they couldn't express a different way.
Wow. So we know that the voice has helped us groom these connections, create these connections. Somehow we used the voice to create, as we said, solidarity, bring ourselves together. I wonder, do we still use our voices in the same ways to socially groom? Because technology, that's got to come up, right? Has technology put a barrier up now in the way we use our voices to say, here I am, or to groom each other? Is that changing as far as you can tell?
So there are a couple of ways to answer this question. And maybe that would be important to say a bit more about how voice, even today, is still very much a touch. There is this very deep connection between the hands and the voice. And that starts with dexterity. there's really no other part of our bodies that we can control voluntarily so precisely, the hands and the voice box. The hand is about 60 plus muscles. And one fun fact is that you don't actually have any muscles in your fingers, and the fingers are controlled by muscles in the palm and the forearm. But you have about 60 muscles in both hands combined. And you have about 100 muscles that you need to perfectly synchronize to produce a vocal sound. So that's kind of a first parallel. But the control of both hands and voice in the brain are also very connected. So in our motor cortex, we have a mapping of every part of our body. And it's the same for everyone. Mm. But this mapping is not in orders that would seem normal from head to toe, for example. And there's much more space dedicated for more precise control. And what we see is that in the brain, the part for control of hands and the part for control of voice box is located right next to each other. So there is some interesting theories about why. And also the fact that some of our closest cousins, chimpanzees, have really fine control of their hand, but not of their voice box. So one hypothesis is that language might have originally started with manual gesture and was later on transmitted to the voice box. So that's what we call the theory of the gestural vocal proto-language. And it's supported by a lot of different elements. And one of them is handedness. Most humans are right-handed, which is also pretty uncommon among other species. Other species are also have a handedness, but it's not so drastic toward one side. And this right-handedness means that because the brain is contralateral, so every side of our body is controlled by the opposite side in the brain, mean that we have a left cerebral dominance for hand control. But we also have a left cerebral dominance for voice control. So those are many of the parallels between touch and voice. So really, even though they're not that close, you know, bodies are very close, closely connected in the brain and in evolution. So bringing back this notion of touch.
Wow. Why don't we like to hear our voices on the radio when they're recorded? Why is that?
Do you really don't like hearing your voice?
No, I definitely do not. So my wife would say, you love it. And especially those of us who talk a lot, people are like, what do you mean you talk a lot? It's surely you like hearing yourself talk. But why don't we? We most of us don't anyway.
Well, we can get to that. We think we don't, but we actually do.
Okay, great. So
the most common explanation is like, but that's not how you're used to your voice. So there is this gap, this cognitive shift. And indeed, we ourselves, we hear our voice mainly through bone conduction. So that amplified more the lower frequencies, and then other people hear us through the air. And when we hear ourselves recorded, it's also through the air. So it's closer to how other people hear us. But that's just the first of many filters that we have in our body that filters out on the voice. We are made to not hear our voice. When you produce a sound, our own auditory cortex shuts down. So our brain doesn't want to listen to the voice. It's really... Again, there are theories, but it's really an optimization process. I know what I'm going to sound like, so I don't need to spend energy analyzing and processing what comes back. But actually, if you record someone and mix that with a lot of other recordings, and people don't know if they're listening to their own recording or not, they will rate their voice as sounding really nice.
Wow.
So we actually like our voice. But it's really this... I think it has to do with this projection of us. Is that me? Who am I? Which is something that we keep in the back of our brain, but we try to not put to the forefront all the time. And I think when we hear our voice recorded, that suddenly becomes something that's important.
When did you first start paying attention to your own voice? At what point in the process? Was that before you did research on the voice? Or was that, like, when did you start paying attention?
Well, I know I'm paying attention right now. So I started working on the voice about 10 years ago when I arrived in the U.S., when I arrived at MIT. And I think after about a year, I really decided that the voice is a way for me to merge so many of my other interests, to touch many different fields. I'm just going to go with that. And I think at that point, I started started reading a lot about everything that is in the voice, what it reveals in our social dynamics, and I became really self-conscious. that was tricky, and I thought, it's not possible. I can't keep going on like that with my object of study being so close to my own subject. And then it passed. It was surprising that it passed. I think it was maybe a signal of, okay, you can keep working on that.
You have said that our voices are like a mask we wear to project who we are. So let's talk about our voices and our identity.
Often people think of the voice as this marker of who a person is, but the voice changes throughout life. And even in terms of gender, it's interesting because as we discover and change and shape our identity through life, often the voice is a marker of those and is a companion of those. It's not only something that you project, but it's something that feeds back to you. So it's something that always is there to remind you who you are or who you don't want to be or who you sound like. So if our voice doesn't match who we want to be, who we feel inside, then it's a constant reminder of this mismatch.
Most people don't realize how much you use your voice and how important it is until you lose it. Imagine seeing any woman in her 30s walking down the street, and as soon as she opens her mouth, she sounds like this. And how jarring that transition is. Now imagine being that person and getting used to seeing those types of reactions every time you open your mouth. Eventually you just stop talking.
This is Samantha Taylor. She's transgender, and she's felt like a woman ever since she can remember. She was raised in a conservative family, a military family, strict LDS. So she kept her identity to herself for a long time. Until she couldn't anymore. She was engaged at the time, and she told her fiancé.
At the time, you know, it was the early aughts, and the thing to do was still to, quote-unquote, pray away the gay. And so that's what I tried doing for about another 10 years.
It didn't work. Samantha got divorced and began a process of trying to get her body to match her identity.
One of the first things I did to begin my transition was to start working on my voice. It's one of the things you have the most control over as a trans person. And for somebody who spent 30-some years feeling like I had no control over who I was and how I was viewed by the world, having something that I could directly control and change was a relief. It was refreshing. These days, I like my voice. I still hate hearing myself on recordings a little bit, but it's me. I recognize it's my voice. My brain doesn't completely revolt from this. We're already so good at taking away voices from minorities, and when you're trans, you're literally losing your voice. Learning to have a voice that matches who you are is super important for being able to actually exist in and interact with and participate in society.
What do you hear in that story?
It's a very strong story. I think it's And it's one that is felt by a lot of people. I think that brings us to this kind of core element of the voice as the intersection of society, biases, neurology, biology, how we relate to our voice, how we can gain control over our vocal posture, meaning anything that is in our control. And some of them can still take a lot to learn and to adapt, but also this important presence of vocal biases that affect a lot of people. And I think even though I like to say, oh, I work on voice beyond words, you first need a voice to be able to express words. And it's important to realize that anyone has something to express. and that the diversity of voices is really what creates the symphony of our society.
It matters to her that her voice matches her image of who she is. Why, I guess? Do we know that, why that's important? I guess, is it a learned sort of thing? Is this cultural? Is it we want to be accepted? Is it we have an image of it? Or is all of those things?
Your voice is the sound you hear the most in your life.
Yeah.
And it changes, like we change. It changes sometimes slowly, sometimes fast. And I like this, the metaphor of the mask, because being a person, that's another etymology. The origin of the word person come from the personae, which was the masks that were worn in antiquity during theater play. And the mask had two purposes. One of them was to display who the character was. So, for example, women were not allowed to play in theater, in drama. But the second was that those masks were acoustic tools. They were there to help carry your voice in the atrium, to touch more people. And I think there's still this notion that our voice is what we project and we hear it back. And there is often this disconnection, and being aware of it and having the ability, the agency to play with this mismatch is very important to not live in a cognitive dissonance. And for some people it matters, for some people it matters less. But for those for whom it matters, it's really a question of existence. How do I exist in the world through my voice, and how does that reflect toward who I am?
Rebecca Kleinberger. She's an expert on the human voice and a researcher at the Media Lab at MIT. Earlier this week, she helped us celebrate 20 years of Radio West by joining us on stage at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Rebecca Kleinberger is explaining the remarkable versatility of the human voice. She's a voice researcher, and she joined us earlier this week on stage at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City.
I want to ask you about this technology. I don't know if this is a technological thing, but could we change in some way our own self-perception of our voice? One of the things that it raises the question of something you've talked about or maybe even worked on is the way we hear our own voice as music. And Marilyn Monroe comes to mind. Will you tell that story? I think this is interesting.
Yeah, so I was saying that when we speak, our auditory cortex shuts down. Actually, when we speak, it's a very interesting and intriguing phenomenon that is, we hear ourselves different from the way we hear or listen to other people. Because when we activate our voice box, we don't create one signal to the muscle, but there's always two signals present. One is sent to the muscle and the other remains in the brain to inform the brain that there will be motion. It's the same reason why I don't need to look at my arm to know where my arm is, because there's always a second signal called an efference copy. So my brain is aware of my position. And so for the voice, we also have this efference copy. And so instead of our brain listening to a voice to try to analyze it as sound, our brain just always compares it to the expected signal. And for most of us, it works great most of the time. But there is kind of a key population for which it creates issue, or we think that's the reason why it creates issues, is the population of people who stutter. And stuttering is a very common in the population. It's estimated that 1% of the adult population in the world stutters. It's more common in children. Most children grow out of it. I can talk about stuttering for ages. But
we think that it really has to do with this comparison of signal. And this also specific idea that there is a pathway in the brain, always the same, when we listen to ourselves. But interestingly, people who stutter seem to be very fluent when they sing. So it's a different pathway in the brain when we make sounds that are not speech. And one of the work we've done is transforming the way people who stutter hear themselves and transforming it more in a musical signal. And when you do that, they're able to speak normally and have a way reduced amount of stutter. And stuttering, there are a lot of techniques and tricks that people can try to appear more fluent, to have less apparent disfluencies. And one of them is the story I like from Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn is said to have had a very strong stutter. And a voice coach once told her that maybe to avoid stuttering, she could try to always whisper her way into words. Then she would ease the muscle and she would have less issue with stuttering. And it's said to have given her this iconic voice that we all know.
What comes to mind for me is also that scene in The King's Speech. Mm-hmm. Some of you are familiar with it, which involves the Geoffrey Rush character, I can't remember his name, mm-hmm. The doctor plays music.
Yeah.
For the king.
Yeah, and it changing the way we hear our own voice or adding elements to it or even how the acoustic of a room transforms our voice. Every time we step inside or outside or in a church or in a small room, that changes how we hear ourselves. And the more we do little experiments, we can affect a lot of processes in the brain just non-invasively by changing how we hear our voice. A classic one is if you start hearing your voice with a delay, you basically can't keep talking. You start having a slurred speech. It's quite amusing, but it's quite powerful in terms of how the way we hear ourselves and this habit that we all have can have deep implications in our self-perception, in our ability to communicate, in our ability to perceive the world around us again.
One of the another one of the important parts of your work is working with animals and the idea of creating better understanding between species. What can we learn about animals, animal voices? What are you learning about that?
So I grew up in a farm in France. So I grew up with a lot of animals, and I think that's one big element that drive me towards this research. And I think I was also very lucky. About 5 years ago, I was contacted by the San Diego Zoo, who asked me if I was interested in deploying any of my work at the zoo. And I was like, yes, don't ask me twice. And then we were able to have some great collaboration with researchers there and think about the concept of soundscape in zoos and how sound affect animals and how we can try to improve their well-being. But that also brought me to think about where our human voice come from, what we can learn from animal voices, both in terms of language, in terms of sonority, in terms of this social grooming and how we interact as a species, but also from the research on the inner voice, thinking that our inner world, our sonic inner world, our inner experience of voices is driven from motor action, has its roots in motor action. And we think in sound in ways that can be dissociated from words and language. And I think this can give us a lot of insight about potentially animals' inner lives. By relating to our own inner lives and thinking how beyond language we create this inner world, which I think a lot of animals who have voices, a lot of animals who can create sound can also do. I like the example of crickets. Crickets have a completely different way of creating sounds, and yet they still have this efferent copy in their brain of prediction of the sound they're going to produce from motor action. So crickets may have an inner voice of cricket.
Wow.
And you can think about that with, for example, one of the loudest animals on Earth is a very small shrimp who lives in the water and has this ability to create extremely loud sound by by imploding bubbles underwater and that stun their prey. But what does that mean if they have such a loud inner voice?
I like that idea. Exercise, if there's something that you can think of where, because we're an incredibly divided culture, community, country, world right now in a lot of ways. I'm not saying there's a way to fix it necessarily, but I do wonder how you think about voice in a way to help bring us together in some way. How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting to think about voice and inner voice as kind of those two sisters that always somehow work together and that are a membrane between the outside world and the inner world, who we are and who we are in society. And this notion of society, this notion of others as some great element to it. That's how we survived as a species. That's how we create bond. That's, you know, social species is really in the name, right? But it also comes with issues. And I think vocal biases is an important one. Vocal biases, we all have voice biases against minorities, against female voices, against some accents, some sonorities, some nasal sound. And they are created by society, but they are reinforced by our brain because our brain is so used to listening to voices that it does a lot of shortcuts to get to what information I need. And those shortcuts can hinder human interaction. And because we're so used to doing them, we reinforce those biases all the time. And we are not really used to pausing and thinking about what in this voice makes me have such and such reaction. So this togetherness is important, but it's also important to think about it and reflect on what it means. Because the individuality of the voice is also something that's absolutely beautiful. And we heard the story of this woman earlier. But society does keep us in a little box about what is acceptable to do with a voice. You don't use a voice louder than a certain sound. And there is sometimes some dissociation between what our brain tells us to do versus what society tells us to do. That's something we see a lot in women's voices. Women, specifically in the workplace, adopt a way lower voice than what their natural vocal posture is. And I think it's a mix between how we hear other women around us, how we hear some women models in our lives, what we think is going to make us heard, and sometimes what actually makes us be heard or not. But there is also a level of liberation from refusing some of those rules in society and trying to find some element of a voice that is different. And I build different type of technology to get different feedback on our own voice. And one answer I love getting from people is what they say, well, I had no idea I could make such a sound because I brought people to a little place in their voice that they haven't tried before and it was there the whole time. So that's something that can be fun to try.
We had the New Yorker writer John Colapinto on the show last year, and he wrote a book about the human voice. And part of it was really personal, how he had damaged his own voice and how that changed his personality, it changed his identity. But Colapinto explores something, Rebecca, that you've written about, that in early human societies, like we were talking about earlier, group singing evolved as this tool for building loyalty and solidarity. And Colapinto told us that even at an amateur level, the act of blending your voice with others in song will cause the brain to secrete the chemical oxytocin. It's a hormone that creates sensations of bonding and unity.
Humans, we are a social species. And the voice is pretty central to creating groups and to creating this connection. there are centers of the brain that are related to this notion of feeling more individualistic or feeling more altruistic. And it seemed that there might be also outside-in ways to act on that. There are great research done on people singing together and how performing actions, mirroring action of each other, does truly affect those centers in the brain and our ability to feel more as a group versus as a single being. Thinking about it not as what unites us is our thoughts and is our beliefs versus someone else's belief, but what unites us is more deeply ingrained in what it means to be human. And the other things come after. Common action leads to common perception. So acting together can make us feel together, whoever is in the room, part of something bigger than just ourselves.
That's Rebecca Kleinberger. She studies the human voice and is working on voice technology and voice-based experiences as a researcher at the Media Lab at MIT. The conversation was recorded at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in Salt Lake City. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Tim Slover, and Kerry Watson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.